From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. I'm Tyne Morgan, and here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes. Lingering fallout from the drought.
We've lost cotton farmers, be it young or old. We've had older producers that have exacerbated a lot of their long-term financial income.
We travel to West Texas to see how farmers are weathering the storm. More confirmed cases of avian influenza in dairy and poultry.
The risk to the consuming public is very, very, very low because we know that pasteurization destroys the virus. And so drinking milk, eating beef, that remains safe.
It's rattling the cattle markets. We'll tell you why. And a tasty history of one of America's most iconic ice cream brands.
George Vandenbroek worked for the Sioux City Journal at the time and saw that the contest was happening, and his son actually is the one that saw Blue Bunny in the window during Easter, and he said, "Dad, what about Blue Bunny?"
We're traveling the countryside with Andrew McCray.
U.S. Farm Report, presented by Pioneer. What's next happens when the name on a cap matches the power of one's purpose. Pioneer, what's next happens here.
Now for the news, more cases of avian flu are being reported across portions of the ag industry. The illness has now hit Michigan's largest egg producer, Herbuck's Poultry Ranch in Ionia County. It comes on the heels of the biggest producer of fresh eggs in the country, Cal-Maine Foods, announcing it would be forced to depopulate about 1.6 million laying hens at a facility in Texas. Ohio state officials are confirming avian influenza was detected in cows in a dairy operation in the northwest part of the state. That marks 13 cases of highly pathogenic avian influenza in dairy cattle in six states. Officials continue to say the food supply is safe, but experts tell us it may only be a matter of time before the beef cattle herd will be impacted by the virus. The head of the American Association of Bovine Practitioners telling AgriTalk that transmission of the virus to beef cattle cannot be ruled out because the virus cannot distinguish dairy cattle from beef cattle.
There currently are no reports of it in the beef herd right now. But certainly producers and veterinarians should be on alert to monitor and watch for any of those symptoms.
However, meat scientists with Texas Tech telling us whether it's meat from dairy cattle or beef cattle, chicken or even eggs, there is no danger to the public as long as those products are not consumed raw. And while the live and feeder cattle futures have been volatile in reaction to avian flu news, the milk market itself has a more muted response. One market expert telling us that with the talk of reduced milk production and dairy cows from the illness, you might expect the milk market to rally. Yet the cash market has not reacted, and the Class 3 milk futures have seen only a slight decline. However, the reaction has been somewhat subdued, with people being reassured pasteurization will kill the virus.
I mean, really, since this was confirmed to have the bird flu in dairy cattle, we've really, under some of the closer months, we've dropped, you know, between 40 and 60 cents a hundredweight with some of the early contracts making new contract lows. So it really hasn't had much of an impact at all on as far as our milk price is concerned.
Schmall says the milk market had already seen a steep sell-off prior to the announcement of HPAI due to weaker demand, losing over $2 per hundredweight from late February into mid-March. A temporary channel is now open at the site of the Baltimore Bridge collapse. A tugboat pushing a barge with the jet fuel for the Defense Department was the first vessel to cross the alternate channel. Officials are also moving forward on creating a southwest channel for deeper draft vessels. Some barges and tugs have been stuck in the Port of Baltimore since the collapse of the Key Bridge are also scheduled to pass through the channel. The port handles more cars and farm equipment than any other U.S. facility. And the latest quarterly hogs and pigs report from USDA shows increased productivity and more pigs per litter. The inventory as of March 1st for all hogs and pigs was 74.6 million head, up 1% from last year, but down 2% from December. The average pigs saved per litter was 11.53 pigs for the December through February time period. That's up almost 5% from last year, which is much higher jump than what most analysts had expected heading into the report.
Pigs per litter are escalating, and the farmers are doing a good job with that. So we're seeing, you know, potentially more hogs available. The other part is we've been seeing some nice, strong cash prices over the last couple of weeks. And we saw we're seeing some good export interest.
The total number of hogs under contract owned by operations with over 5,000 head, but raised by contractees, accounted for 52% of total U.S. hog inventory. That's up 1% from last year. Well, signs of spring and signals to plant. We'll have a check of your farm country forecast coming up next.
U.S. Farm Report weather is brought to you by H&S Manufacturing. Maximize baleage yield with less time and effort with the LW1100 Line Wrap Bale Wrapper. You can wrap round or square bales, and the automatic operating mode allows for a one-person operation.
Time now for a check of weather with meteorologist Martin Lauermoore joining us this week. Martin, after some snow last week, the forecast looks prime for planting across the Midwest this upcoming week. And I'm hearing from a lot of farmers who think they will start planting then.
Yeah, the first low has made its way off into the Atlantic, and now we're already watching for the next one. So you see this ridge is kind of developing in the eastern part of the U.S. This right here will make things a little bit on the more mild side for some of us. You can see the leftovers of that low. It's made its way out onto the Atlantic. This is going to continue its way out of here, but already looking at another one. We're seeing this one pushing its way into the central part of the U.S. This will move through into that Sunday and Monday. And of course, Monday, a lot of you getting out to see that eclipse. We're going to be kind of right on the edge, right along that line. You can see where the line would go for that line of totality, continuing its way upwards across parts of the U.S. And that's going to be a little bit of a double-edged coin. A lot of those places to just to the north of the eclipse will be a little more cloudier. So the south of the eclipse, maybe a little bit on the drier side. So we're hopefully going to be seeing that much better improvement. But what we're looking at in the future as well is how much warmer we're going to be getting. Most of the country is going to start seeing temperatures getting well above average. When that low makes its way across the U.S., it's going to leave behind some pretty warm air for the western parts of the country. Could start melting some of that snowpack in the mountains as well. But you're also seeing that low just to the south could be bringing us a little bit of that cooler air. When it comes to the precipitation, though, again, same story. Going to be seeing with that low passing by, it's going to be quite wet out there. Some parts of the southern U.S. way above the average for that normal for our second full week of April, but behind the low, very dry. So again, western part of the country, next couple of days, going to start seeing getting warmer and drier, staying a little cooler and wetter out toward the eastern and southern portion of the U.S. here. So the drought monitor is overall doing pretty good. We got some places out toward New Mexico and Texas and a patch of Iowa that is sitting in that extreme drought or higher, but most of the country, especially eastern part, is doing relatively good on that drought monitor. So we're hoping to set ourselves up really well for this growing season as we get into our spring and summertime. Really don't want to stop that rainfall once we get into that summer, am I right? But as we get into next several weeks, we're going to be watching this pretty closely on the drought monitor. But the rainfall over the next 7 days, still seeing more of that pushing through again. Not expecting much for southern parts of New Mexico, places that really do need some of that rainfall, but plenty of the rain going to be coming in across parts of the southern U.S., especially in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas.
When we come back, we're off to the Plains Cotton Growers Annual Meeting. From a look at the cotton landscape in 2024 to questions about the Farm Bill. We'll cover it all in our marketing roundtables next.
U.S. Farm Report on the road from the Plains Cotton Growers Annual Meeting is brought to you by Ag Texas Farm Credit Services. Your success, our purpose. Capital Farm Credit. Together, we're better. And by StoneX, your cotton price risk management experts.
Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. Excited to be from the Plains Cotton Growers Annual Meeting. A lot to talk about, especially coming fresh off of that USDA Prospective Plantings Report last Friday. We have Jody Campici as well as Bart Fisher and Brad Wettelman. Jody, I'm going to start with you. Because as we look at the Prospective Plantings Report, there's a couple question marks. One of those came with cotton acres. I mean, 10.7 million acres of cotton. 4% change from last year, but what is the biggest question mark and the biggest change you could see from now until the June acreage report from USDA, do you think?
So, I mean, I think the real question is, and if you take a look at the industry and the trade and what they were expecting, most were expecting a higher number. So we were 10.2 last year, 10.7 this year. I think most were expecting somewhere in the 11.2 to 11.5 range. So within that, I think looking at Texas is probably the biggest question mark. Texas acreage from the planting intentions is not really that much different than last year. And when you look at kind of where is the acreage going, well, it doesn't show that it's actually going to any other principal crops. We actually see a decline in overall primary crop acreage. So you know, it's still early. I think we could see some changes and maybe some additional acreage could pop up somewhere in Texas.
Yeah, so before we go on, let's talk about those principal acres, because when we see USDA say that we lost 6 million acres of principal acres year over year, that's huge. I mean, even if you look at hay, even if you look at some of the other specialty crops, how do you see a 6 million acre swing in just 1 year?
You know, again, I think it's just those who filled out the survey, maybe they, you know, nobody has any real great thoughts on any acreage right now on most commodities. So nothing really looks that great right now. So it may be that producers decided that maybe we're going to cut back acreage here, we're going to cut back acreage there. But I don't know. Overall, I expect to see that number coming up with overall acreage when we see the next report.
And Bart, there was, you know, corn acreage. That was a little bit of a surprise, too. Some thought that we would see more corn acres than what USDA printed on Friday. But when you look at where corn prices have trended over the past year, is that really a big surprise to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always look at the intentions report somewhat skeptically, right? It's a very early look. We're talking March 1. We're surveying growers on their intentions, but still, you know, ways out from planting in a lot of cases. And so if you look at the results, which I know you had covered last week, to me it parallels where price projections are. So if we look, you know, from the peak in 22 down to 24, just on corn, as you mentioned, prices are off about 33%. So I don't think it's a surprise to see corn acreage dropping. Also, similarly, not a huge surprise then to see some compensation on both beans and cotton, too, because, you know, soybeans over that two-year period, corn's at 33% off, you know, beans about 25% and cotton about 20% off. And so if you look at it relative to one another, to me, the intentions report fairly, you know, well paralleled where the prices we're seeing in the market.
Well, and if you look at prices today, I mean, it underscores, you know, what we're talking about here at Plains Cotton Growers is needing a change in the reference price whenever we look at the next farm bill. As you see what's about to come out of the House Ag Committee and as they mock up the version of that farm bill, how big of a change do you expect to see in reference prices?
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question right now, right? And a lot of it comes down to funding. So, I mean, if you go back to the conversation we were having on prices, and you look beyond this two-year drop, if you look to the long, you know, the long-term prices are fairly stagnant in the long run. And, you know, we just got back from D.C. a week ago where we were doing our baseline outlook for the House and Senate Ag Committees. And if you translate those low long-term prices into farm-level results, the farm-level results, you know, for all the representative farms we maintain around the country, you know, it's not a terribly rosy picture. And not to be negative here today, but to me it highlights exactly why a safety net's needed, particularly if you look. Yeah, I mean, and there's even growing pressure in the Midwest, but certainly in cotton. You know, we have 13 representative cotton farms, and 9 of those by 2029 are classified as either poor or in marginal financial condition, mostly in poor financial condition, all because we've got stickiness in input prices, but then we have, you know, output prices softening. And so it does point to the need for improvements in the safety net. And with respect, you know, to the magnitude, I mean, I don't know that we're going to, if you looked at it just in terms of cost of production, we're up, I mean, roughly on average 30% from where we had been just in terms of cost. And so that's an easy baseline to start with. But, you know, I don't know that we're going to have the funding to get to 30% increases across the board, because we're talking north of $100 billion at that point.
Brad, is it a guarantee that we will see a change in reference price out of this first look of the House version of the Farm Bill?
I think out of the House side, you will see a change in the reference prices. Chairman G.T. Thompson has said over and over again that he wants to look at reference prices and doesn't want to move forward without strengthening the farm safety net.
We know that that requires additional funding. So do we know where that additional funding is coming from?
I think the committee's going to be very creative in the ways that they look, and they're going to look in multiple areas. They're still working with CBO. The Congressional Budget Office has been very difficult to work with. They've been slow to get things back. But luckily, Chairman Arrington has been really nice to work with so far, and the committee's worked well with him, and hopefully they can move on with that and find some additional funding.
All right, well, from an outlook on prices to some questions on the latest round of disaster aid, we have a lot more to cover. But first, we need to take a quick break right here on U.S. Farm Report. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. Again, bringing you the show from the Plains Cotton Growers annual meeting. All right, when we get into the price outlook, Jody, we talked about the supply situation, a big question mark about acreage this year. But what is the price outlook for cotton if the demand picture stays the same?
So, you know, the current demand picture, demand is improving, but we're still struggling. And as we look ahead, it's really going to depend on kind of what happens with the U.S. crop for this year. Not just the U.S. crop, though. It's really going to depend on what happens in Brazil and Australia. Brazil continues to expand their acreage, produce a bigger crop. Australia has water, so their crop should be good as well. So all of those things contributed could create some price pressure for this next year.
Other than South America and the supply there, what is the biggest wild card for cotton demand this year?
The biggest wild card for cotton demand, we're going to have to see where economic growth goes. So right now, current world GDP growth projections are about 3.1% for 2024. Now, we don't generally see a large swing in cotton demand from one year to the next, a large bounce back with growth at about 3%. So we're going to need to see better economic growth, better cotton demand.
You mentioned that you just went to D.C. and you had your baseline outlook. If prices stay where they are today, what is the outlook for the cotton industry? And really, you ran the numbers with rice as well. What does it look like for those growers this year?
Yeah, I think one thing, in the very near term, we ended up, in price discovery on crop insurance this year, roughly in the same spot we were in last year. And so I think that was it was encouraging that we got that bump kind of early on, in the lead into this growing season. So I think with all the drought pressure we've been under the last couple of years, there's a bunch of financial pressure in the countryside. Yeah, I think we could have added to that pressure, had we not been able to lock in, in that 83-cent set range. But going forward, I think it's absolutely imperative that we raise reference prices. And certainly on the House side, just judging by the workload that we're under right now for the Ag Committee, I think it is clear they're working on putting together a bill, because they have us doing a tremendous amount of analysis. I think the same goes for the Senate side too, though. Senator Bozeman from Arkansas has also said, it was a non-starter for him to move a farm bill that didn't adjust reference prices as well. And so, to me, the long-term outlook for cotton farms is sort of dependent on making improvements to those reference prices.
It's not just about reference prices. A lot of talk here about disaster aid. And the latest round of funding that we saw come out of D.C. did not include disaster aid. The last round of disaster aid, some question marks about some disparities there. Will we see any changes? Will USDA make this right, Brett?
I don't know if USDA will make the 2022 right without some push from Congress or other means. I think you saw two major departures in the 2022 ERP, where they put in a progressive factor where it paid less as the year loss grew. And then second, they also only paid crop insurance premiums back to an underserved category. And I think those two major departures are the things that need to be fixed and that we will look at going forward if we do a future disaster program.
Yeah, and you look at the devastating drought this year and the financial hardship that it is creating for these growers. Did that program help?
I think it helped, but it didn't go far enough for the losses that you saw that were really deep losses when you get into those six-figure losses. If you're only seeing a 10% return on what your loss was, it's really not enough to make those growers be able to go back to the bank and get the funding they need for the next year.
Or do you think Congress is hearing that this last round of disaster aid, that the changes in it did not work for this area that faced that severe drought?
I think they're absolutely hearing it. I also wonder if that's one reason why there wasn't disaster assistance included in this latest spending package, because of frustration. I think it's also partly because there's an impending farm bill too, but we do have this period between the two where there are growers, with real need out there, and it's certainly exacerbated, as Brad mentioned, by how this last round was designed by the department.
Thank you, Bart, as well as Brad, as well as Jody. We appreciate you being on the panel this weekend. All right, we need to take a quick break, and then we'll have much more right here on U.S. Farm Report.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Tractor Tales. This week, we're Texas-bound. Check out a 1915 Titan 1225.
Well, this is a 1915 Titan tractor, which was a massive tractor in that day and time, and when the plains was being, a lot of it being broken out and put in the cultivation, which all this was ranch land originally around the Lubbock and Panhandle Plains of Texas. And one of our members, current members of the museum, restored this tractor in his farm shop. It's immaculately done. It's sort of a wow effect. And we sort of situated here when they're entering the glass doors. It's one of the first they see after they come around in front of the first exhibit. So it's really a wow factor. That was a massive machine. You just think in 15, we were still predominantly farming with horses, and a tractor this size shows up on the plane. It's a pretty chilling effect.
Still to come, two consecutive years of drought in Texas has been absolutely devastating for cotton growers, and the fallout extends well beyond the farm. That's actually our Farm Journal report coming up next.
You're watching U.S. Farm Report, trusted, timely, tradition.
It's known as the largest cotton patch in the U.S. The pocket of West Texas in the Texas Panhandle produces 35% of all the cotton grown in the U.S. It's such a vital piece of the cotton industry in the U.S., and as we saw firsthand during our trip to Lubbock, Texas this week, the fallout from the drought is still a major concern, as they also plant seeds of hope this season. Glimpses of green,
it's wet, it's not mud, but it's wet,
are also signs of hope, as any moisture here in West Texas is cherished.
3 weeks ago, I came out here and I was able to push this probe down 2 feet without a hammer.
But 3 weeks later, high winds have quickly changed the picture.
So I can still get it down there, but it's harder than it was.
As farmers here still are holding on to hope, more rain is on the way.
We will be in need of some good springtime rains and planting rains.
Rex Kennedy farms around 10,000 acres with his brother-in-law. 8,000 of that is dry land. And last year, they didn't have a dry land crop at all.
Compared to the last 2 years, we're a little bit ahead of where we were this time of year as far as winter moisture.
This year, the moisture situation is better, but El Nino typically brings bouts of snow for farmers here, and this year they didn't catch any of that.
January was a little bit above average. March has been above average. But, you know, you're talking about on our farms, what we've averaged is about 6 to 8 tenths. Now, that's above average, but it's certainly not as much as we'd like.
Still in this area, cotton is the core crop, and Kennedy says they are growing slightly more cotton in 2024.
My operation, I have all cotton equipment, not really set up for rains. Now, if the prices were to be dramatically different with cotton hovering around 80 cents, yes, I would look for something different. But right now, and like always, in West Texas, cotton is key.
Looking at the state as a whole, last week's prospective plantings report from USDA showed a slight decline in cotton acres in Texas this year. But nationwide, USDA thinks cotton acres could be up 4%.
No, I don't think anybody's surprised about the number of cotton acres. I think what has happened over time is, you know, in our area or in the South, the corn-cotton ratio has trended in favor of cotton most of the winter and into the spring. The 10.7 million all acres by USDA, maybe it's an underestimate, but not by much.
Darren Hudson is an ag economist with Texas Tech. He says for 2024, the supply story hinges on abandonment here.
If we had a reasonable summer, sort of normal weather kind of pattern, you could see a pretty sizable crop just based on, you know, the number of acres that get planted. And with the forecasted La Nina sort of cooling off and drying off during the summer, that's not favorable to cotton production.
Farmers in this area have already faced two consecutive years of drought, and another dry summer would be devastating.
Crop insurance helps smooth a bit for producers, but only 65% of expected revenue, so it's certainly not going to save them from losing money. I think a lot of producers are sort of upside down on the production loans. They've been, you know, refinancing, trying to roll that forward, and the banks have been working with them for now, but it, you know, certainly that's a risk to the banks. It's the younger farmers that are more leveraged that are really feeling that pinch. And that's the group that we least want to see, you know, get out of agriculture.
And it's something Plains Cotton Growers CEO Cody Besant is also concerned about.
We've lost cotton farmers, be it young or old. We've had older producers that have exacerbated a lot of their long-term financial income. to the point that they just can't simply sustain that. And we've had younger producers because it's such a difficult industry to get into, especially if you don't have family or friends to help you segue into the industry, that it's very difficult to get your footing and survive if you don't at least make a decent crop and be able to weather some of the financial risk that is bestowed upon the industry.
Bessent says fallout from the drought isn't just unfolding across farms. It's also happening with crucial infrastructure like cotton gins.
We saw some infrastructure, be it gins or other downstream related segments, completely go out of business. In many instances, when a cotton gin, by example, goes offline, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for it to come back offline because it's a one-trick shot for that industry.
So how essential is it for cotton farmers here to not just break even, but make a profit this year? Bessent says it's huge.
There's a lot of volatility, a lot of financial duress in the marketplace coming in out of our second year. Third year is really difficult for the industry to survive, be it a producer or downstream segments. So we've got to make a crop. This will make or break an individual for the most part.
It's not just concerns about making a crop, but also the price of new crop cotton.
It's hovering around 82 to 85 cents. And that is an absolute must.
If you'd have told me 5 or 10 years ago that 82-cent cotton would not be profitable, I probably would have laughed at you. But today, that's pretty close to the break-even.
As Kennedy and other area farmers prep fields to plant, the risk this year is high.
Anywhere from 40 to 60% of the price or the cost of production is in the ground when you put the seed in.
My main concern coming up in 24, I guess number one would be timely rain. Number two, these input costs with no farm program. It's gonna be hard to make this country pencil out without a drastic change in our farm policy, the economy adjusting to where we can get some of these input costs where they're not so high.
From increased costs to barely break-even prices for the cotton planted this spring, West Texas farmers continue to find new ways to weather the storm. Well, another storm farmers there are weathering is with crop insurance providers. Several providers either already announced they'll no longer service farmers in that area, or many are exploring that option. But in March, RMA issued a cease and desist order so no more providers would leave. Bessent telling me they're happy RMA stepped in, but it's still a challenge ahead as they try to find a balance between farmers and crop insurance providers. And that won't be easy. All right, when we come back, a positive sign in trade relations between the U.S. and China. Ag Around the World is next.
U.S. Farm Report on the road from the Plains Cotton Growers Annual Meeting is brought to you by Ag Texas Farm Credit Services. Your success, our purpose. Capital Farm Credit. Together, we're better. And by StoneX, your cotton price risk management experts.
Now for a glimpse of Ag Around the World, President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping this week holding their first conversation since their November summit. It's reported the two discussed Taiwan, artificial intelligence, and security issues during a phone call. The White House described the call as, quote, candid and constructive. Xi told President Biden the two countries should adhere to the bottom line of no clash, no confrontation as one of the principles for this year. The call lasted nearly 2 hours. And that call coming on the heels of President Xi expressing optimism last week about the future of U.S.-China relations, including the potential resolution to a continued trade dispute. The comments made during a meeting with CEOs of American companies in Beijing, President Xi emphasizing the importance of cooperation with regards to trade, agriculture, climate, and artificial intelligence. The remarks aimed at bolstering foreign investment in China, which has recently seen declines. And Ukraine grain exports have fallen nearly 7%. Through the first 9 months of the latest marketing year, Ukraine exported 35.4 million metric tons of grain. That's down more than 2.5 million metric tons from the same time last year. The exports included more than 19 million metric tons of corn, 14 million metric tons of wheat, and almost 2 million metric tons of barley. That's a look at your headlines for Ag Around the World. Well, Chip Flory having some candid conversations about avian flu and the impacts on agriculture. We'll talk about it in Chip's Corner next. Welcome back to Chip's Corner this weekend. Chip, we've been covering highly pathogenic avian influenza since we heard that there was this mystery illness in dairy cattle, confirmed that it was HPAI. This story, though, is evolving by the day. More confirmed cases in dairies, more confirmed cases, and just devastating news to a couple of large poultry operations. Yep. But I know you've been following this story closely as well.
Yeah, HPAI, Tyne, it's a story that we'd almost become numb to just simply because it was commonplace in the poultry industry. But as soon as it makes the jump over to the dairy industry, it's a completely different story now than what it was. And the way that the cattle market has been reacting to it is a whole other story that we'll get to here in a bit. But the important thing to understand is that they are working hard to get this under control. We had a conversation with Dr. Fred Gingrich from the Bovine Practitioners, Association of Bovine Practitioners, last week on AgriTalk. I thought it was very important for people to understand that transmission from animal to human is very rare.
There's been 200 cases of HPAI in mammals. You know, this is basically a global problem, this HPAI virus. Who's at risk when you're talking about humans? You know, our biggest at-risk population would be the veterinarians and employees of dairy farms. Because they are primarily around the infected animals. The risk to the consuming public is very, very, very low because we know that pasteurization destroys the virus. And so drinking milk, eating beef, that remains safe.
That remains safe. That I also had a conversation with Texas Ag Commissioner Sid Miller on Thursday's AgriTalk. I thought it was very important. We talked about how consumers are reacting. And the safety of the food supply. Honestly, if you are buying your product, your milk, through traditional grocery stores, there is no risk here, Tyne. There is no risk that the virus is going to make its way through a pasteurized gallon of milk into your refrigerator. It's just not going to happen. That's what the whole food system is designed to do, is to keep our food supply safe. And it's doing just that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Dr. Gingrich, he has been up on top of this. He's been my go-to source since this story broke. He's so good at just giving us the facts. I did ask him Thursday, Chip. I asked him, is there any way that we're seeing this transmitted from cow to employee to cow? Is that how we're seeing some of the spread throughout these dairy operations? And he said he does not know any cases like that yet. So I did ask him that question, but it's been interesting to see that the dairy markets really haven't reacted to the news much, not the story in cattle.
Right, right. And as quickly as it is spreading, Tyne, your question about cow to human, back to cow, excellent question. One that we need to think about and we need to consider and we need to guard against. The biosecurity efforts inside of the dairies has to be ramped up to prevent any of that from happening. But you're exactly right. With cattle prices up around all-time highs, or they backed off of the all-time highs, but the first reaction happened when we were very close to all-time highs. What it does is it shows the vulnerability of a market when we are trading at thin air levels, you know, those all-time high levels. It doesn't, it can take something as like this HPAI in dairy to have a big impact on the beef market just simply because of concern. I think it's completely manufactured, Tyne, to be honest with you, but it is still concern over how consumers might react to the threat to food safety. You've got to have the price protection in place by now.
Well, as the CDC pointed out again this week, the milk that you consume, if it's pasteurized, and the meat that you consume, if it's cooked to the right temperature, it's safe. The products are safe, and they're trying to reassure consumers of that. But you're right, the fear of the unknown. Well, Chip Flory, thank you so much for joining us this weekend. You can catch Chip 10 a.m. Central for AgriTalk AM, and then 2 p.m. Central for AgriTalk PM. A big thank you, Chip. All right, we need to take a quick break, and then we're traveling the countryside with Andrew McCray next. The delicious history of one of America's most iconic ice cream brands. We travel the countryside this weekend with Andrew McCray.
For our American countryside stories, we go to several museums, but you know it's going to be a great day when you go to an ice cream museum and you get to taste the exhibits.
It all began back in 1913. Fred Wells Jr. began a milk delivery business based in Lamar's, Iowa. In 1925, he partnered with his brother Harry. As Beth Meyer explains, they soon hit the difficult Depression years, and that led to an important decision that impacts us yet today.
It was a time when times were tough, and even now when times are tough, people still turn to ice cream, and it makes everybody smile. That's one thing working here. Everybody's happy to walk in our doors.
The Wells brothers had begun an ice cream business, but it needed a name, so they advertised a contest in the Sioux City newspaper to name the company. They paid a $25 prize to the winner.
George Vandenbroek worked for the Sioux City Journal at the time and saw that the contest was happening, and his son actually is the one that saw Blue Bunny in the window during Easter, and he said, "Dad, what about Blue Bunny?"
And it's been Blue Bunny ever since. The production facility here continued to churn out more and more of the product over the years, and the company grew with that demand.
The town grew around that, and after that they needed to expand, or wanted to expand, because they knew they wanted to make more ice cream, so they built the South Ice Cream Plant, and then not long after that, the congressional bill was signed that we were named the ice cream capital of the world because more ice cream is produced here than anywhere else in the country, and that stands true today.
No matter the season, you'll probably find something ice cream related taking place in Lamar's, both inside and outside the visitor center.
So the town has really embraced being the ice cream capital of the world. We have ice cream days every year. We celebrate ice cream for 4 days in June. And then we also, if you drive around town, we have ice cream cones, and every ice cream cone is decorated differently.
Today, Wells Blue Bunny also has a production facility in New York State and another near Las Vegas to help with the logistics of shipping ice cream to the end user in a timely fashion. Beth and I did this interview inside the visitor center, where you can choose from a lot of flavors for your own dish or cone, which leads many people to ask, what is the most popular flavor?
Salted caramel craze is probably what people choose the most. We also have bunny tracks is right up there, as well as super chunky cookie dough. But vanilla is what we use the most because that's the base for all of our shakes, our extreme sundaes, all the delicious things that we get to make. So vanilla is what we definitely go through the most.
Beth says people can eat and learn about ice cream here. But one piece of the story people may not realize is that all of the milk used in the facility is sourced from within 75 miles of here. And many of those farmers help tell the story from farm to store shelf as well.
They give tours of the dairies, and they teach the kids that come through here where the milk comes from that's making the ice cream. So the kids truly get to learn the process from beginning to end.
It's a fun place to visit, and just about everyone loves ice cream. With so many flavors from which to choose, the Visitor Center is a hit for many a trip for visitor and local alike. Traveling the countryside in Lamar's, Iowa, I'm Andrew McCray.
I'm telling you, Andrew gets all the tasty and good stories. You can hear more of Andrew's travels on Farm Journal's YouTube page. Well, planting is already underway in some areas. We'll tell you where. That's next.
U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by Germinator Steel Closing Wheels. Perfected in conventional, excels in no-till. Order your Germinator Closing Wheels today.
Looks like we'll be talking a lot more about planting with the forecast next week, but in Texas, it's already underway. Nearly half of the corn crop has already been planted, 37% of sorghum, and 5% of cotton. And thanks to Texas Farm Bureau, we're able to hear the story behind one farmer as he plants another season.
Most farmers will tell you, seeing the seed come out of the ground, the beginning of that process, it is what really gets you excited, gives you hope for the whole year. My name is Richard Beyer. We grow row crops, corn, cotton, milo. We have a few beef cattle. It's my wife and I, along with our three girls. I grew up working with my dad on a rice farm. He grew rice for several years. Then after college, I came home and started farming on my own, mostly row crops. It's challenging, like I mentioned before, but it's also gratifying. For me, I get to work outside. And while there's many similarities every year, each year is different. Working through the whole process, getting to the end of every year. And the hope is that we're gonna have a big yield at the end. We all want to ring the bell every year, so to speak. We really need to have a good yield. There's so much that we don't control, whether it's weather, markets, inflation, things like that. We don't have control over that, so we're yield dependent whenever it comes down to it. With this one planter, we can do about 200 acres a day. We usually take 5 to 7 days to plant our crops. So with corn, I would say within a week's time, we'll have all our corn planted in the ground. Then we'll switch to our milo crop, and it's about the same. And then we'll start with cotton. I'm sure if you talk to other farmers, they'll say it gets in your blood. And I think that everybody has something that they have a passion for. And most farmers, this is our passion. This is what we do. It's who we are. And I honestly can't think that I would ever do anything else. For me, this is just who I am, and it's who my family is, and it's what we do.
Thanks to Texas Farm Bureau, and a big thank you to Plains Cotton Growers for hosting us this week in Lubbock. And that does it for U.S. Farm Report this weekend. Be sure to join us next weekend as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.